it's funny to think about the way that the book addresses the title of the book, because we put this collection together from stories I've written over the years, and my editor and I saw a theme about motherhood and daughterhood and also sisterhood and aunthood and what it means to be a grandmother. But maybe the most potent of the stories addressed issues and difficulties between mothers and daughters. And some people ask me why I always write about such rough situations. I have to say, well, we all know about rough situations and easy ones, and it's the trouble that gets our attention, and it's the trouble that makes us write. So I'm probably going to have to go around asking my mother's forgiveness a whole bunch for titling this book this way, because I have a very good relationship with my mom, and yet I can, you know, looking back, seeing the difficulties of being a daughter, a teenage daughter especially, and the difficulties of being a mother of a teenage daughter have really captured my interest. And I think living in a time that we do, when there's a lot of revelations in the zeitgeist, I guess, about molestation, for one, yeah, and issues of mothers and daughters coming to grips or not coming to grips with things that happen to daughters and also that happen to mothers. And so I focused on those for a lot of these stories.
You write a lot about women, girls going through being abused, being molested. I did read somewhere that it's one in every three women have that kind of an experience. It may even be higher than that.
Yeah, I think I have read that it might be even higher than that, maybe 40% of women,
yeah,
or something.
So unfortunately, maybe a lot of your readers can identify with what you're saying.
Yeah, I really think so. And I think maybe the reason the number may be even higher than that is that so many of the violations of young women are of a nature that is difficult to describe, you know, and it may just be something like a young woman experiencing the wrong kind of attention, and just experiencing that can cause troubles that are difficult to describe. And maybe we live in a society, and I would say this is probably true of all societies across the globe, that has not quite addressed the way in which sexuality in our times works.
Yeah, yeah.
In a time where we don't want women to be married when they're 17. You know, the way that we deal with it may have been okay in a different time, but there certainly are, you know, it's certainly worth looking at, I think. And so I really never got tired of looking at it throughout the writing of these stories and thinking about it.
And yet at the same time, your characters, your female characters are empowered, they're strong, they come through a lot of grit, but they've survived, and more than survived in many cases.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. The other side of this issue is that I am not interested in writing about women as victims.
Right.
You know, I want to see, even though clearly women, young women, are often victimized, I hope that their victimhood is not the main thing about them. And that's been a challenge in writing a lot of my stories, is to have women encounter difficulties, but to still be, to some degree, master of their fates.
Or in some cases, you catch them in some kind of an in-between stage. There's this one story, A Multitude of Sins. it kind of made me think of Stephen King's Misery. Tell us about that story.
That's a story in which the story about a woman in her maybe early 60s, and her husband has just been given, announced that he's going to die. He's on hospice and he's home. And this is the first time that this woman is been in control of her life, and she's now in control of her husband, and she finds herself abusing her husband. And as the story unfolds, we see that she herself was abused throughout the marriage by her husband. And instead of it, her becoming kinder in the end, she becomes mean in an interesting way, I hope. And so,
and with an element of humor in there too. Yeah. All the tossing of Ensure cans.
Yeah, I hope that we can have a sense of humor about this, because otherwise we're doomed.
But what I, on a more serious note, what I found fascinating too is that she thought she had settled all her feelings through this marriage. And it was only when she had control to some degree that all of these emotions came up.
Yeah, she had imagined herself all through her life being a good person and a good Christian. And she had seen herself forgiving her husband continually for his violations of her. And it turns out in the end that that wasn't enough, that she had held on to the anger, and that the anger had really had affected her and made her who she was. And maybe now she can resolve that.
And then there's, and again, there's that element of humor. There's Roscoe the dog and how your character reunites with an ex-lover.
Yes, in a very, I don't want to give it away, but he's in a different form than he was when he was her lover. But this was a woman who had put up with a lot. This is a young woman, and the story has a lighter tone. But the young woman had put up with a lot of abuse from an ex-lover, and now she was in a good, healthy relationship. And she assumes that everything's hunky-dory until she encounters this old lover and finds herself still drawn to him. And she has to go through a bit.
I like to think it's a myth about being drawn to the bad boy, or...
I think to some degree it's drawn to the bad boy, but I think for her it's more drawn to the very thing that formed her romantically, perhaps, because she was very young when she had her this lover. And so I think it's difficult for all of us to let go of relationships of the past, you know, and this maybe could relate to relationships within the family between mothers and daughters and sisters, and also those early romantic relationships that form us.
Now, Bonnie, you've been showered with awards, so people are obviously relating to what you write, and not just locally. You've got a fan club here, but nationally, perhaps even internationally, you've been recognized as well. So I'm wondering, what is it that you attribute it to? Of course, great writing, but something more, authenticity, the grit? What do you think's going on out there? What'd
that's
you hit?
That's a rough question to ask the author, because...
You wish you knew.
I am so honored when people like what I write. It comes always as a surprise as well. And I know it's not that I'm trying to be humble. It's just that I grew up thinking that writing had to address important people in big cities who were doing things that changed the world. And when I finally got my stride as a writer was when I started writing about the kind of people I grew up with and the people around me. And I guess I had assumed that this meant that my writing could not be important to people in the world. And so it really, really comes as a wonderful surprise when it turns out that people elsewhere like my writing. And saying that, I also had some worry that my writing might be, when it was received in New York City, that maybe people here wouldn't like it. So that worried me a lot. But now I feel like I'm speaking with people, anybody who wants to listen, I'm speaking to them.
Love trails you wherever you go.
But it is something that we learn, I think, over and over again as fiction writers, is that it is in the particular that we find the universal, and we have to remind ourselves the ways in which this happens, because we can't expect it to happen naturally, but when it does, we're really happy.
And yet, you know, even if it's down home and it's about the donkeys you raise and that kind of a thing, when someone looks at your bio, Bonnie, it's quite incredible. You've lived an incredible life. Aside from making great chocolate, you ran away with a circus, you hitchhiked the U.S. and Canada, you biked the Swiss Alps, you led adventure tours in Russia and the Baltics, Romania, Bulgaria, and you practice Koburyu Kobudo weapons. What is that about?
Well, I always wanted to have adventures. You know, as a girl, I was, I don't admit this very often, but I'm kind of a scaredy cat and I worry a lot. And so even as a youth, I was kind of scared of doing things, but that somehow worked its opposite. Like it made me feel like I had to address those fears and do as much as I possibly could. And I grew up maybe with not so many resources, you know, resources to travel and such. And so I just decided that I was going to find a way to travel and have adventures no matter what. And to my surprise, I was able to find adventure just by opening my mind and opening my heart, I guess, and taking chances also vis-a-vis the hitchhiking, which I don't advise anyone to do. But if my nieces hitchhike, I will lock them in a room. But I always have felt that I wanted to be exposed to as many different kinds of people as possible. And that has helped. And maybe that's helped because it helped me see my own people better, you know, by being elsewhere where people really are different and where people are seem exotic, that gives me insight into my own place in the world where I still feel more comfortable, which is here. And I should also say that when I was young, I kind of knew I wasn't a very good writer. I always did want to write, but I knew that my writing was not like the writing I loved. And so in a weird way, I felt like that was the best use of my time, to run around and to experience life. And so I'm very glad I did, because I do spend an awful lot of time now just sitting around writing.
But I wonder if with that you hit upon one of the secrets of maybe not so much sitting in a classroom, not to put down MFAs, but get out there and live a rich life and then come home and write.
Yeah, I think it worked well for me. And I did get an MFA fairly much later in life. So I started my MFA when I was about 35. And it's funny because I didn't even know what an MFA was when I just went to go take a writing class with Jamie Gordon at Western. And then she was the one who said, get an MFA. This will really help with your writing. And I'm very glad that I waited, because I was ready. I feel like I'd done a lot of the basic work that I could do myself. And then working in the MFA program introduced me to new writers and helped me with a lot of the technical aspects of writing.
When we talked about the travels that you did, Romania made its way into one of the stories in this collection as well.
Yes, I'm so happy to finally write a story about Romania, because I normally am interested in writing about Michigan. That's what I love, and that's the landscape that interests me most. But I bike through a certain part of Transylvania a lot of times. Transylvania is the part of Transylvania that's in Romania. And I'd bike through there a lot of times on the same road. And I felt that I had some profound experience every time I was on this road. And this was a part of leading the bike tours that I did. And I worked on that story for a long time. I had written an initial draft of it many years ago, and I was hoping that I could find a place for it in this collection, and I was so glad that I did. But it really forced me to work in a different way. I had to do a different kind of research to make sure that I got the details right.
So when you write a story, does it very often, is it something that you return to again and again over years? It's not just something you sit down and write in one piece. How does that work?
Yeah, I know. Isn't that crazy? We think of these short stories as just something that a person might sit down and write. And that's the joy of reading a short story, is that we can just sit down and read the whole thing. But for me, stories usually take years. They sometimes take decades. I think the longest I've worked on a story is about 25 years, and I found that finally I got it.
Ooh, which one is that?
Well, the story in American Salvage called Bringing Belle Home, I worked on for 25 years, and because I knew it had to go in that collection, and I knew this was my chance to really get it, and I just kind of the last, one of the last stories I worked on. But for this collection, I have two stories that I wrote in a hurry. I shouldn't say in a hurry, but I stories that I wrote new, and by that I mean less than 6 months to write the stories. But then those were the stories I found myself editing like crazy at the very end. And so I think about 6 months is the quickest I can write a story. And it really demanded my full attention for a long time.
And some of your stories have grown into your novels, characters?
Yes, that's true. I sometimes have finished a story only to discover that it's just the beginning of a longer story.
Anything like that in this collection, do you think? Any tickle there?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not feeling it yet in this collection. I'm not feeling the story that wants to go on and on. I like to say that my novels are actually failed short stories because I try to write a short story, and then if it seems that it just can't wrap up, then that means I have a novel.
So I'm going to ask here, let's see, longest story in terms of writing 25 years. How long does it take to write a novel?
Well, my novel, Once Upon a River, I generally say that it took me about 5 years because it took me from the conception of it being a novel, it took 5 years. However, some of the material in that was from the very first stories I had written in the MFA program. So I guess it took at least 15 years to write Once Upon a River, if we look at it that way.
And what are you more comfortable with? Or is it just that you sometimes need a break, or do you work on them simultaneously? And you also write poetry.
Yeah, I like to have a few things going on at the same time because it prevents writer's block. I feel that writer's block is often a response to trying to push forward one piece of work when it's not time to push forward yet, when there's maybe some unconscious work that needs to be done that I can hopefully do while bicycling or driving. And so I want to make sure to use whatever time I have for writing well, so then I feel free to turn to another project. And for me, poetry has been such a fun project because it lets me focus on language. You know, it lets me move away from plot and even character development and just move into having fun with language. And I think all writers have had the experience where the problems are solved by language in a fun way or a surprising way that, maybe a lot of us forget. The best writers never forget it. You know, I learned from Jamie Gordon about language and about how language is the key to getting at the deeper issues. But I forget it. I need to remind myself.
So is there a poetry collection that might show up at some point, do you think?
Yeah, I do have a collection that I haven't really done much with since I formed it as a collection. But I hope to at some point. The problem now is that I get myself all booked up with fiction projects, and so I have to put the other projects on hold. I also have a book of essays that someday I hope to get published, but I just haven't been able to focus on it.
Oh, wow. Creative riches here. So you're going on quite a book tour, aren't you, with this new book?
I know. It's crazy. I can't believe it. I'm going to be at least 2 months only home one night in a row. And I'm really flattered that I got to have a book tour. Often now publishers feel that that's not the best use of a writer's time. to be running around to bookstores, but they also know at Norton that I do love to hang out at bookstores. It's one of the best places to be, and I love talking to readers, and I'm looking forward to it. So I'll be going to the West Coast and the East Coast, and I will be reading. Sometimes I'm reading with some interesting people. Some of you may know Carolyn Shute. I'm going to get to read with Carolyn Shute in New York City, so that will be great. But I'm also doing a lot in the Midwest, and I'm trying to hit every bookstore in Michigan. So,
oh, that's a job.
So look for any whatever town you're in. Just give me a nudge, and I'll try to get there.
Now, does your website list all of these events if somebody wants to find a place and time to go hear Bonnie?
Yep. There's a link on my website, which I have not yet updated. Boy, that's the work. Well, maybe I have. By the time this runs, I'm gonna get it updated. On my website, you'll find a link that says events, and that connects to my events blog. And that I try to keep that updated all the time. And I'm real easy to reach on the website. So if anybody wants to know where I am, just send me an email.
And you've got a great website. I spent some time on it recently, and you've got some great advice there for new writers. And there's a lot of good material on there.
Oh,
it's not just my new book and that's it. You know, there's good material on there for new writers too. Go visit Bonnie. And what's the link?
Is BonnieJoCampbell.com.
And talk to us a little bit about your book launch, which is going to happen here in Kalamazoo, right?
Oh, yeah. It's going to be a great time. It'll be October 3rd, which is a Saturday. And I will start with a reading at BookBug at about 11:30 in the morning. And we'll hang out there for a while and sign books and talk to folks. And then we'll head to a party at Old Dog Tavern. At 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock, we'll hang out there. We'll have some music. I think we're going to have a band called Duke and the Dauphins, which you might recognize as a reference to Huck Finn. And we're going to, I'm hoping to have Pin the Tail on the Donkey. And maybe we'll bring the real donkeys down there, but maybe not.
Oh, that'd be great.
But it should be really fun. And we'll have book sales there. Michigan News is going to be selling books at the book party.
And could you read to us just so we get a little taste of Mothers Tell Your Daughters?
Yeah, I'm going to read from the very first story in the collection. It's very short, and I should be able to read the whole thing. So it's called Sleepover. Ed and I were making out by candlelight on the couch. Pammy was in my bedroom with Ed's brother. She wanted to be in the dark because her face was broke out. "We were wishing your head could be on Pammy's body," Ed said. "You two together would make the perfect girl." I took it as a compliment. Unlike Pammy, I was flat-chested. Ed kissed my mouth, my throat, my collarbone. He pressed his pelvis into mine. The full moon over the driveway reminded me of a single headlamp or a giant eyeball. Ed's tongue was in my ear when Mom's car lights hit the picture window. Ed slid to the floor and whistled for his brother, who crawled from the bedroom on hands and knees. They scurried out the screen door, into the backyard, and hopped the fence. Pammy and I fixed our clothes and hurriedly dealt a hand of Michigan rummy by candlelight. "You girls are going to ruin your eyes," Mom said, switching on the table lamp. When Mom went to change her clothes, Pammy whispered that she'd let Ed's brother go into her pants. Her hair was messed up, so I smoothed it behind her ear. "Too bad this show isn't in color," Pammy said later when we were watching Frankenstein. While the doctor was still cobbling together body parts, Pammy fell asleep with her small, pretty feet on my lap. I stayed awake, though, and saw the men from the town band together to kill the monster.